I'll call the meeting to order. It is 8:01 a.m., March 8th, 2010. In attendance today are co-chair Meyer, vice chair Davis, Senator Stevens, Senator Huggins, and myself, co-chair Thomas. We have a quorum to conduct business. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for being here. Today, the committee will continue its consideration of Senate Bill 224, an act establishing the governor's performance scholarship program. To bring everybody up to speed on where we are and how we got here, I'd like to briefly just review the committee's last few discussions regarding SB 224. February 15th, the committee adopted a committee substitute for SB 224 for purposes of discussion. On the 17th of February, the committee received amendments from the Department of Education it wanted adopted into the administration's original SB 224. February 22nd, staff walked the committee through those different versions as well as various amendments from the House. And the committee discussed concerns and issues. February 26, Commissioner Ledoux and Diane Behrens spoke to the old CS as well as parts of the governor's submitted SB 224 with numerous amendments from the governor and the committee members on our table and many more under consideration in the House Education Committee. Co-Chair Meyer and I asked staff last Monday, March 1st, to give the committee a presentation on all those proposed amendments so the committee could discuss them and so staff could use those discussions as a basis of creating a new committee substitute for SB 224. The CS has been drafted and is available for committee consideration. So we can discuss the new CS, I will entertain a motion to table the governor's original SB 224 and take up the new committee substitute as the working document. Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that we table Senate Bill 224 version 26GS2771/A.
Thank you. Without objection, Senate Bill, or is there objection, I guess I should ask. Without objection, Senate Bill 224, version 26GS2771/A has been tabled. Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 224, version 26GS2771/S for the purposes of discussion.
Is there objection? Without objection, committee substitute for Senate Bill 224 version S has been adopted and is now before the committee. Thank you, Senator Meyer. There are a substantial number of differences between the original SB 244 and the CS now before us, and the co-committee aides are prepared to explain and walk through those differences with the committee. Mr. Richmond and Mr. Stewart, would you please come forward and place yourselves on the record?
Joe Mosort, co-committee aide for the Senate Education Committee.
Maury Richmond, co-committee aide for the Senate Education Committee.
Thank you, gentlemen. If you would please proceed with your walkthrough.
As you look at the bill before you, there are probably three major differences from the governor's bill, which is what we're comparing this to, just so we're all on the same page today. And I'll go briefly over what the major differences are, and then we'll go through it and look at some of the more minor differences and how the major differences line up. The first major difference is that there was a groundswell of opinion that we heard from both the House and the Senate that career should not be on a second-tier status, that it should be given equal standing with the other scholarships, that if a student is a straight-A student, and wants to go to career school, they should have everything available to that they need that someone going to an academic institution would have. The amendments that reflect this ends up essentially taking the career segment out as a separate path and merging it in. So in the governor's bill, you have one path that goes to academic and one path that goes to career. In this committee substitute, you have one merit-based performance scholarship that can be used for a career school or for an academic institution. So that's the first major change. The second major change is the addition of the needs-based amendment, which we've gone over before. And the third major change is allowing for non-traditional students, which we'll go, which we discussed the last time we were together. And we'll go through the bill and show you essentially things that we've marked up after we put all the amendments together and got this back. There are things we saw that concerned us a little bit. There are concerns that the administration has, and what we'd like to do is go through and point out some of the differences, highlight what this bill does for you so you can get a fuller understanding of it, and then point out some concerns that have been noted as we've been going through it. You have on your tables, this is essentially, it's like a side-by-side of the original bill submitted by the governor and then the new committee substitute, and I'll be using that to go through. And then you have the committee substitute, which my esteemed colleague beside me judiciously marked up and made some notes on for you, and you have color additions for you. So section one, the first change reflects the two of the changes that we talked about. Instead of calling it an academic scholarship, or you see in line nine, it adds the phrase merit, and it's a merit-based performance scholarship. Throughout this, we're keeping the notion of merit-based up front, and the notion this is a performance scholarship. And so that occurs throughout the document. And I won't refer to them every time it happens, but that does occur throughout the entire document. Section two, there is no change. Section three, there is no change. If you go to the committee substitute, page five, there is a section four. Section four was drafted not by our request, but as legal was looking at it, they assumed that the corporation, the Alaska Student Loan Corporation, would be administering this program. In discussions with Diane Behrens, that is not the case. And this program would reside solely within the commission. There are reasons, and there's a letter that you have been provided in your packet explaining why more in detail. It is the House's intention in talking with their staff that Section 4 be removed, and we would recommend to staff that Section 4 be removed from this committee substitute before it would be passed on from this body. The whole section. The whole section deals with the powers of the corporation in administering the program, but throughout the rest of the document, it talks about the commission. And so this is the only place where the corporation shows up. If this were excised out, it, from the best of my knowledge, would not affect any other part of the bill.
And you're talking about the entire section four, so we're talking about half of page five, all of page
all the way to page seven, line 27.
28. Okay.
Substantively speaking, yeah. The only real change in the existing statute was simply the addition of the reference to AS 43091 through 43890. But they actually put the entire section in just to make that reference.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Continue.
Mr. Chairman.
Certainly.
Mr. Stevens. Let me make sure I understand this. So the commission is comfortable with this. This is the way they want it, and this is also the way the Alaska Student Loan Corporation wants it.
That's correct.
Okay.
Section 5 is in many ways the heart of this document, and that's where we'll see many of the changes. The first thing you'll notice is that the goal section was deleted, and will be at that section will be added as a memo of intent. That will be introduced, where the bill to go to the floor would be introduced on the floor with the bill. The reason for that, this was an amendment that came from Senator Stevens' office, is that we would not want intent language residing within the bill. We would like it to go along aside the bill.
It can still be referenced in matter of court cases. It simply doesn't have the force of law.
Yeah. On line eight, line three. Page 8, line 1. In the House there, and when we first brought this bill up, one of the things that we said is this bill presents a challenge for the schools in the area to rise up to educating the students to the level of being able to attend a major university in this state and performing well there. And this line reflects the nature of that challenge. You know, it's been added for the purpose of ensuring that a rigorous curriculum is available in all high schools in the state. That is in some ways intent, but it lays within the bill what the whole bill is about, which this has been called a reform bill, and this just lays that in there, that this is not just a scholarship bill, but it goes beyond that. Going down to page 8, line 3.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Murray, does this open us up in the sense that we know, I think we know, there's some schools that won't be able to meet this criteria? And by virtue of it's our standard and we're saying that we're going to make, have the rigorous curriculum, do we open ourselves up liability? I mean, you name the piece of we can't make the schools rigorous.
Through the chair, my understanding, later in the bill, there is a provision for students who reside in areas where there is not the curriculum that they have to take into account. The effect on bringing in students to the whole population of students will be receiving scholarships, but there is an allowance for that later in the bill.
Yeah.
Also,
if I might, that's not what this says. This says in all high schools. Doesn't say
that's
in
correct.
Spite of deleted. So I just asked that, and we need to just let's take a look at that because that's important for us.
There's a new reference added on page 9, line 25 and 26. That was inserted from the governor in the governor's bill, four-year core academic curriculum, which may include virtual curriculum. And again, here on line 8 or page 8, line 1, it simply says that a rigorous curriculum is available in all high schools, and through virtual means, i.e., distance ed, we would be asking the department to make a commitment that it would make that those resources available to those schools.
Yeah.
As well they should.
I think what Senator Huggins is saying, though, is a pretty strong statement beginning on the previous page. The governor's performance scholarship program is established for the purpose of ensuring. That's a pretty strong statement. I think that's probably your concern, isn't it, Senator
Huggins? And Mr. Chairman, I thank you, and I appreciate that. And as far as the virtual schools, I mean, that's a great idea, and we all want it to happen. But, you know, it takes time to mature programs. And I just don't want us to create a standard for ourselves, all is inclusive, that we can't live by and opens us up for whatever kind of critique.
Respectfully, through the chair, I'm not being a lawyer, I can't answer your question.
Right. No, I understand.
That's an excellent question.
Right.
So,
On
line 3 of page 8, there's language that talks about the two previous types of program, the merit-based academic scholarship and the merit-based career scholarship. That was deleted. And again, that reflects the fact that there is now essentially one scholarship that can be used in an academic or a career track. Page 8, line 22, there was proviso that a graduate, line 22, previously it said, Alaska resident who has graduated or will graduate within 6 months of the date of application. That was deleted to provide a longer time frame for students per the amendment of Senator Stevens wanting to allow for more non-traditional students. The same is true in line 25. That was deleted. And then in line 30, there was a proviso that said that the scholarship will be received and utilized no later than 6 years after the beginning of the first school year, and that whole paragraph was deleted. And so basically, it's in terms of time frames, it's an open-ended time frame. Line 31 talks about a minimum grade point average. Before, I think it just said minimum standards, and this brings out having a grade point average. That average is not specified. I assume that would come in regulations. But just to flag that there is there will be an average when a student gets the scholarship that will be set. And so if they spend the first their first semester drinking and carousing and having all sorts of fun more than they're studying, then they stand a chance of losing their scholarship. But if they flunk one course, the 2.5 has been thrown around as a possible, and that's the case in other areas, so that they could, if they had trouble in one course, that wouldn't necessarily disqualify them. So, page 9.
But there is no, where is the number or the grade point average referenced in it, or have we not?
That is not currently in this bill.
Okay.
I assume it would be established in regulations, and that would probably be more a question for the commission to answer, unless you did want to put in a grade point average in the bill.
Okay. All right.
Senator Stevens.
And then Senator Huggins. So if a student is having difficulty, I mean, my advice has always been drop out as quickly as you can. Withdraw from a class, not all classes, just the one you're having trouble with, because you don't want that on your record. But in this case, there's a minimum requirement of classes to be taken and credits to be earned so that they really can't, maybe you can explain that.
Well, this is for continuing performance once you're in your university or technical career school. It's for maintaining your scholarship.
Right, right.
You already earned it with your high grades in high school, but you have to maintain performance through college or through your career school.
Well, what I'm asking, is there a minimum number of credit hours you have to take? Is it not simply a matter just of withdrawing from class you're having trouble with, because that would put you below the number of credit hours you need to have?
Through the chair, my understanding, and I believe the commissioner can probably speak more accurately to this than I can, but my understanding is you have to be enrolled at least half-time, which is, I believe, more than
six credit hours.
Six or more credit hours. If you fall below that, then you would lose your whole scholarship. If you are enrolled part-time, your scholarship would be prorated, so you would lose half of your scholarship, I assume, if you dropped a significant number of courses.
I see.
I think if you drop below 12 courses, it would be prorated to a half-time scholarship.
Okay, thank you.
Well, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would highly recommend that we look at some minimum standard of grade point average and put it in here so that there's no wavering on that, number one. Number two, you know, the transition from high school, according to what the high school is, can be traumatic. And I guess it brings to mind to me that would there be any wisdom to having a probationary period if I had a D in a course and I was kind of on the ropes, but I could maintain my scholarship for a short probationary period, but if it didn't pan out after that, it kind of fades away. But I would just ask us to consider that.
I see them feverishly writing down some of our suggestions here. So.
We'll have more discussions with the senators and get their wishes on this as we work towards getting a final product.
Yeah, that's our intent today, obviously, is to go through this one and get as many things flushed out as we possibly can that are concerning folks and try and get this one in shape to move forward with it.
I would like to add at this point, if any of you do have concerns that haven't come up today or concerns that are still laying on the table, please have your staff contact us, and we'll be glad to talk with them about those concerns. Where was I? Okay, page 9, line 14 through 18 was added. The department shall adopt regulations to include an application procedure for the award of a scholarship or for the resumption of a scholarship award for an eligible applicant who is either withdrawn from or delayed enrollment in a qualified post-secondary institution in the state and who has been admitted to a qualified post-secondary institution regardless of age. And again, this goes back to the non-traditional requirement, non-traditional language that's letting a student, in this case, the student who does bomb out in their first semester, but who does show promise, would have a way to try to reinstate their scholarship, I assume. On page 9, line 19, line 20, line 24, these add this is language that reflects that this is now a performant merit-based scholarship. And so merit-based or performance was substituted in those lines to reflect the unicameral, unified nature of this bill. Line 9, which has already been referred to by my colleague, talks about a virtual curriculum may be added, and so a student who was in a rural school doing a virtual curriculum, that would be considered a valid part of the student's curriculum.
Line 9, which
or line,
actually, excuse me, page 9, line 25 through 26.
Okay, and backing up just a second to the wording for 14 through 18, that's more than just somebody bombing out. That's somebody that, unless it's somewhere else in here, someone that might have gone in the military or had to go to work or just almost any circumstance that arises that interrupts their career.
That is correct. Someone who was starting a family right after college unexpectedly, for whatever reason, they would have a way to re-enter the program.
Very good. Continue, please.
Okay. Page 10, line 1, we had talked about programmatic standards, and one of the standards was the Regulus curriculum that would be offered. The first change in that is moving the social studies from 3 to 4. There was some talk about, and I've heard discussions about people wanting something with fine arts or culture and heritage or things like that. And so instead of a 3, we've actually tightened up the requirements a little bit. They would have to take 4 units of social studies, which could include if they were doing a foreign language and math, they could use that foreign language, for instance, as one of their social studies curriculum. We've received emails from the foreign language folks who are angry that we left that out, and which will be taken up in a later point. So so that changes from 3 years of social studies with no additional provisos for the arts or whatever to 4 years of social studies, which could include foreign language. And then we added the second component for a student who is not going to go on a math engineering science track, but who may be going law or something with demanding less mathematical skills. 3 years of mathematics, 4 years of language arts, 3 years of science, 4 years of social studies, and 2 years of a foreign language or Alaska Native language. And in the House amendment, which I put in here, and I'll flag this for you, originally we had talked about 2 years of a foreign language or Alaska Native language. This added 5 fine arts or cultural heritage. Whether or not you wanted that to remain in this particular bill would be up to you, but I wanted to flag that that's a little different from what we had talked about before in this committee.
Certainly.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Murray, when you look at these standards and then you go to the present day minimum required subjects and electives, what does it do to it?
All of these exceed the standards, through the chair, all of these exceed the standards that are found both in state statutes and within individual schools. The individual schools would have to follow the state statutes.
No, I don't understand, but let me ask another way. What remains, how many hours remains for electives?
Part of that would depend, through the chair, on where the student was early. Some students will take higher level math at an earlier age, and by the time they're a senior, they could have 4 units of math and not have to take a semester of math. It's hard to say because each student is going to be a little different case. A student who was on the ball and getting these courses in early would have a lot of room for electives. A student who is might have to retake a course would have less rooms for electives. There are more and more electives in many of the schools now, and so I can reflect from my daughter's experience where she actually did the higher level curriculum, but then also took yoga and women's studies and women's history and other units as well. So I can't speak for every high school, though.
Okay.
I think Senator Huggins' question is it within these, she's looking for a raw number, I think. If you take this A or B, how many remaining credit hours are available for electives?
That might be better answered by the commission. For some reason, I'm thinking it's 120.
I'll have to wait till I put
there. Okay. Yeah, that's probably
all right.
Better.
We'll have that addressed, though, so we figure. Yeah. I had the same question myself. So, Senator Stevens.
Could you define cultural heritage for me? Are we talking just, is that sort of a code for Alaska Native cultural heritage, or does cultural heritage include my Western European cultural heritage? What do you mean by that? Do you know?
As I read the bill, through the chair, it says Alaska Native language, a fine arts, or cultural heritage. So I assume that the cultural heritage would not necessarily be confined to Alaska cultural heritage.
So Western civilization, American history, all of those things?
I would believe, as I read the bill, and again, I'm not a lawyer, but as I read the bill, that appears to be what it says.
Maybe we could get a comment from the department on that, as well as what is generally considered cultural heritage classes.
Yes. And again, I flag that is that was not in the governor's original bill, nor was it in any that we had offered you previously. This was found in the House amendment.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, interesting question, just sort of tangential. If English is my second language, and I take English, do I qualify for a foreign language?
I would refer that to the commission.
Nice try.
I have been asked about a Spanish student. Can they take Spanish and have it act as a foreign language? And I believe they can do that.
Yeah, I would assume.
But a Spanish-speaking student. But I don't think you can count English as a foreign language in this country. Okay. Line 4 through 10. We've done line 4 through 10. Okay. Line 11 through 18. This is an amendment offered by the administration where they define the tiers. The award is given in three tiers. The first tier is the A level, which is 3.5 or higher, and that gets 100% of a scholarship. The second tier is B level, and that is 3.0 to 3.5 or 3.49, and that gets 75% of a scholarship. And the third tier is C plus, which is 2.5 to 3.0, and they would get 50% of the scholarship. And so that is defined out in terms of letter grades and percentages. The question came earlier about did we want to set a minimum percentage, and here we actually have the actual grades and grade point average for that. So number three on that page, line 19, talks about minimum score on college entrance exam. That student will be eligible for three tiers of a merit-based award. We had talked about, it doesn't define which one it would be. It would be ACT or SAT. We talked about the need for a standard to keep grade inflation from creeping in. Number four, a process by which the student who meets the grade standards in two of this subsection but does not meet the minimum scores established under three for that tier may apply for a lower tier. Essentially, as I understand that, what that is saying is I may be performing in school at an A level, but my ACT score is not high enough for me to get the A level scholarship, in which case I would then have to apply for a B level scholarship. And so the ACT requirements or SAT requirements would also be tiered into the equivalent of A level, B level, C level. And under this, it would be possible for a student performing at an A level would end up with a B, and depending on regulations, perhaps a C, and perhaps not even, I don't know if they would be disqualified for a scholarship if their ACT level was below the minimum standard.
Senator Stevens.
I remember a fellow student in graduate school who said, I don't know if this ever occurred, that he was taking one class, a graded class, and they wanted to get an A in that, and every class after that he was taking as a pass-fail. So he had a 4-point. Now, I'm not sure how that works. If that's changed, that was the University of Oregon many, many years ago. Where does pass-fail fit into the grading system that you've established here?
I would have to look into that through the chair. I'm assuming that most universities today would not allow a student to get through 4 years doing pass-fail.
You'd think, but...
You would think. Stranger things have probably happened.
I think the commissioner will address that.
I think so, too, yes.
If I may, I would like to bring one thing up. The impression that staff was given by the committee was that it wanted to have some objective benchmark or objective yardstick to guard against grade inflation, but that didn't want the SAT or ACT to necessarily be commanding. Again, we wouldn't want to have an A student who had taken a rigorous curriculum, vigorously applied, and yet has a bad test day and now is ineligible for their scholarship. This amendment itself, I believe, came from the administration. It does appear to partially thread that needle, but we did mark it down as something that the committee would want to, might want to further consider and discuss, because I wasn't sure if it actually got us or got you all as far as you wanted to go. But again, the impression we were given was, again, have it as a yardstick, but not necessarily commanding.
Okay, very good. Senator Meyer.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's a good point. I think we need more discussion on that, and obviously I'll wait till the commissioner comes up here. But somebody who gets a 4.0 taking a rigorous schedule should be able to do pretty good on their ACT or SAT, especially since you can take SAT as many over as many times as you want to. So I would hate to lower our standards too much just because somebody had an off Saturday morning taking the SAT, because they can always take it again. I would be highly suspicious if somebody was a 4.0 and then just had really terrible SAT scores.
Respectfully, through the chair, one of the problems is if you look at the percentiles on ACT, they're skewed towards the higher level, and then they take a radical jump in the middle, and it's hard to peg it for mid-level students. So 36 through 32 is basically 1 and 2 percentiles, and then you drop down, and it drops quickly to 10 percentiles relatively quickly, and then below 10 again relatively quickly. So they would have to stay on top of that in terms of percentiles that actually matched reality.
I did want to refer the committee to the letter from the Commission on Postsecondary Education dated March 3rd, which should be in front of you. If you look at the bottom, it actually gives you the University of Alaska admissions test standards, and they did provide this to us, so that there are, in fact, standards for a student who wishes to enter a degree-seeking program at the University of Alaska. Again, we have an open university. Anyone can go take classes, but for entrance into a degree-seeking program, you do have to meet some minimum standards. I'm not sure how the Department of Education or the Commission is going to want to defer, but it does imply to me that they would be deferring to the university's current standards.
And I would assume this would be
the SAT is used.
I would also assume this would probably be even more difficult for the non-traditional student, or the student that was out for some time and then came back to qualify, having not taken tests probably for some period of time, and some of that information kind of not being quite as germane to the normal lifestyle that they had been living, just working some. But anyhow.
Moving down, still on page 10, line 26. Again, we see we see language that allows it to be used at career schools. Before it said qualified academic university, and this says post-secondary institution as described in AS 1443-835, which would include career and academic and technical schools. Page 11, we see this on line 1, we see the same thing, changing from qualified university or college to post-secondary institution. Line 6, again, merit-based performance scholarship, to note the merit-based need and the inclusion of the two. Page 11, lines 7 through 15, we wanted to point that out, defines the tiers in terms of the allowable awards, and uses different language from language that was before. Here it talks about very high academic achievement, and what the tuition they would get full-time. The differences here would be the original bill pegs it towards the year 2010-2011, and in the amendment that we used here, it pegged it toward 2009 and 2010. The other thing that we need to point out in this section is that in the needs-based section, it clearly says that it's based on cost of attendance at University of Alaska. This section does not say that. And so if a student were to apply to APU where tuition is significantly higher, according to this bill, they would get that significantly higher tuition. And so there should be the recommendation, I think, would be language crafted to make sure that this is in line with a University of Alaska tuition rate and not just tuition. But it does not say that at this point.
And specifically regarding the dates, again, the governor's original bill pegged it at 2010-2011. I believe this was an amendment offered by the House that changed it to 2009-2010, but we know now that there's going to be a 4% tuition increase between last year and this coming fall semester, and we simply wanted to bring that to your attention, that having that date change will have some impact on the amount of tuition or amount of award students would be able to receive in the coming year.
Yeah. Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, I think those are both good points, and hopefully you're taking notes. I think you want to peg it to the University of Alaska rate, because APU is so much higher that we'd be paying out a ton of money. And then second, what was your comment again, Jamal?
2009-2010 versus 2010-2000.
Yeah, 2010, yeah. You might as well use the current rate, so use the 2010-2011,
yeah,
so that you get the higher amount, but not so high that you're going to the APU level. I almost wonder if the House put that in there in hopes of catching those that graduated, that are going to graduate this year, which this has nothing to do with that. Yeah.
We still don't have allowances for that within this.
Right. I think that was Senator Davis's concerns. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
The
VOTEC section.
In line 16, it says explicitly that a student who qualifies for a merit-based scholarship can apply that at a VOTEC school, at a career school. And so that is explicitly stated in this.
And that's the section that essentially made the other references to VOTEC superfluous throughout the bill, mm-hmm, because you can use your scholarship wherever you wish.
And let me jump ahead just a second when we get down there to line 24, just to keep the young enterprising student from getting a scholarship and going to both a VOTEC and UAF or something like that, they may only receive one scholarship. So you can't get a scholarship and go to a career school and then a scholarship and go to an academic institution.
On that line, that line does not did not make much sense when I first read it, but now that you're saying you want to make sure they don't do a vocational and a academic, could we clarify that so that you actually say that? Because to say a student may not receive more than one merit-based scholarship award, it sort of sounds like you've got one chance in a lifetime and that's it. Am I following what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes
sense. Moving back up to line 22, the original bill said a student receiving a merit-based scholarship may remain eligible for to 8 semesters. This changes it to 12 semesters of enrollment at a qualified university or college, or for up to 2 calendar years at a qualified career technical school. So that's a change from 8 to 12. Studies, I think we heard that it takes students a little bit longer sometimes to get through. But line E, merit-based scholarship again, and line 11. On line 30, it starts the needs-based scholarship, and we've gone over that amendment before, and there's no substantial change to that amendment. The rest of the bill essentially sticks statutes in that allows departments to regulate. There's one very long part where they are basically changing a number and sticking statute in there.
Effect.
You want to talk to that?
No.
Okay. There are, and earlier we had talked about, or I'd mentioned a student who was not able to meet the requirements. 1 through 10 on page 13.
What about all this on page 12 that is highlighted?
That is all part of the needs base. We can go over that if you'd like. But that's
yeah,
all.
Yeah, let's go over that.
Please, if you would.
If you would. Again, how this would work is that a student is applying, they would fill out a FAFSA form. If, as indicated in their FAFSA form, they had an unmet need of more than $2,000, they could apply for that unmet need, and they would get 50% of the unmet need after their expected family contribution.
And $2,000.
So, I don't know how much you want to go into detail on this again, but they could essentially, what this says is they could get no more than 50% of unmet need after the student has contributed $2,000 towards that unmet need.
So it's the remainder. It's going to, they're going to contribute $2,000, basically under this plan regardless of what happens.
If they're unmet, only $2,000, they would not get any needs-based
right.
scholarship.
So
if it was, if their unmet need was $4,000, they would contribute two, and they would get an unmet need scholarship, a needs-based scholarship of $2,000.
No, actually, $1,000.
$1,000. Yes, thank you.
Yeah. So there's a, they're always going to have $2,000 out of pocket, so to speak, and potentially more depending on the unmet need.
Depending on their expected family contribution.
Yes. Exactly. Okay.
This is the needs-based amendment as it had been proposed by the administration, and we just simply inserted it.
And the rest of this, going down from there on page 12, the next several lines just shows how that calculation is done, right? And we did have, is that correct? Is that what's going on there? It talks about the maximum amount is 50% of the unmet pension and financial need. That's line 8 and 9, qualified, mm-hmm. shall determine how they determine it.
Yes. Uh-huh.
You might want to just run through that a little bit. That area has always been a little bit confusing to folks, including myself, so.
Okay.
We can all read it, but just to ensure. I know that we had a chart at one time, too, but I don't
know. I don't have the charts with me now. But essentially, if after applying for the FAFSA form, it comes out that I'm at low base, I get a Pell Grant, mm-hmm. And I still have, say, $4,000 that I have to come up with to attend school, I'm expected to kick in $2,000 through work study or my family helping out or something like that.
So you're now left with two.
I'm left with two, and the needs-based meets half of that. And so I would get $1,000 for that, and I then would have to come up with an additional $1,000
yeah.
in student loans or Stafford loan or
sure.
something like that.
But at least three out of your pocket. That circumstance would be three.
That circumstance would be three.
Yeah.
It doesn't appear that this was ever intended to be the fullest of full-ride scholarships.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to at least bring it within reach of most, if not all, students.
Gotcha. Okay.
The best thing about this is it's going to reduce the amount of loans students have, which ends up leveraging out and following them for a long time afterwards.
Right.
And so that will help reduce those. And you reduce loans early on, you reduce interest later out. And so that's probably the most positive effect of the needs-based bill.
As a policy statement, of course, all scholarships now are merit-based scholarships based on high academic performance, and it appears that pretty much every student at least has the possibility of having some needs-based contribution depending on their family's income.
Okay. All right. Please continue.
Section D defines the process, and that is that the student fills out the FAFSA. The institution itself then determines the unmet need. The institution determines the cost of attendance and sends a form to the recipient saying this is what your expected family contribution would be. And so basically this allows it would go through the FAFSA program, which I understand is to be more streamlined fairly soon. So starting on line 16, that pegs the allowable cost of attendance to University of Alaska. And so I'm not sure where you would find an exception to that, but essentially pegs it there, and if something were to come up that would be radically more expensive, it would be equalized out at University of Alaska rates. And then defining two, expected family contribution is the amount that a family is to be paying determined by the FAFSA form. And so that expected family contribution is predefined.
A small difference, but I wasn't sure if you all would consider it substantive. On page 13, line 3, there's a slight linguistic change from the governor's bill. One that I could wholly understand, but one that I thought I would bring to your attention. On line 3, you'll see the word effect. In the governor's original bill, it spoke to a student may pursue alternative means, but the department should consider if those alternative means are applicable, whether or not it would be fair to other students and if it would meet programmatic goals. I could understand removing the programmatic goals because, again, we've pulled that out and are going to send it along with a letter of intent. However, the fairness vis-a-vis students who had taken the quote-unquote normal track was, you know, was something that they were supposed to consider. So I did want to simply point out that that had been a slight linguistic change.
Fairness and programmatic goals was removed, you're saying?
Again, it used to say, and I can find the exact quote, it used to say that the department shall consider fairness vis-a-vis other students as well as whether or not it maintained the programmatic goals as set by the statute.
As I understand it, what happens each year is that if it were to be financed as designed, there would be a $400 million fund, of which around 20 million, 5% would be drawn every year. Hopefully that figure would go up as time went on. And that fund, the 20%, the 5%, which around 20 million, would be distributed among all the students. If you add more students, then they get less money across the board. And so if a huge exemption came up and a lot of students came in, that would lower the amount that every student got. And so I think that's part of, we would have, before we create exemptions, we need to understand how that's going to affect the other students who are getting awards.
I simply liken it to the discussions we have vis-a-vis distributions of the permanent fund. Whenever we add a group, say Peace Corps volunteers who are no longer in state, you know, the cry usually comes up that, hey, you're diminishing my permanent fund by 5 cents. This seems to work about the same way. Again, it's a zero-sum game on a year-by-year basis by how much money is actually allowed or available for distribution to be divided equally among recipients. And every time you add a recipient for whatever reason outside of the normal parameters, you de facto reduce an award to another student potentially. And I just wanted to, again, bring that to your attention, that there had been a slight linguistic change.
Okay.
And then lines 8 through 11 talk about possible waivers that a student could get if their curriculum is not available to them, or if there's rare and unusual circumstances outside of the student's control. A student whose high school is destroyed by a flood, their senior year, and so their grades take a nosedive or something like that. They're on track, but they aren't able to do it. One other thing to point out on line 20, and this is more a question that we feel like we should research more. When they talk about the list of career and technical schools, there are several lists floating around, and we want to make sure that there's a list that the Commission on Post-Secondary Education keeps, there's a list that the Department of Labor and Workforce Development keeps, and we want to make sure we're working from the same list.
Okay.
And so we'll come back to you with more information on that.
I can tell you that there was a fiscal note that went along with the House version of this bill for $25,000 to apparently coordinate the creation and maintenance of this list, whatever this unified list is going to be. But again, there, a list is supposed to be created, and I wanted to make you aware.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. If we reflect back to page 11, line 18, it talks about the statute, Alaska 14. Is this list in that statute? I mean, that's because that's the standard. It's cited in one location, as described in.
There are actually there are multiple quote unquote lists. There's a list that is maintained by the ACPE of authorized technical schools and training that includes a whole range of different kinds of VOTEC institutions, including AvTech, and I believe a couple of hairdressing schools. There's a list that is maintained by the Department of Labor of certified career training facilities. That is a rather extensive list, and it actually goes through almost by a job type. So you have welding schools, and you have a welding school at the University of Alaska. You have a welding school at AvTech. The unions operate welding schools. And there's a third list that is actually within statute of places where a certain pot of money is authorized to go. And I believe that's the one that's referred. So there's three different lists. And I personally, regarding the tax credit bill, have been trying to figure out what the magic list is. And it appears, though, that vis-a-vis this scholarship, they intend to create a magic VOTEC list where you'd be authorized to use your scholarship. It is supposed to come from the Department of Labor, be published by the Commission on Post-Secondary Education, however, be created in consultation between the two. The question would be, how much input do you all wish to have into the creation of that list? because as it stands now, it looks like it will be done purely administratively.
Yeah. I mean, I Mr. Chairman, if I might, I mean, I agree with consolidating the list business, but if it says, as per Alaska statute, something has to change if it's not in there. We can't say one thing in one area and another in what's a prevailing statute.
It, through the chair, it says, as to Alaska statute on page 11, and then on page, where are we, 13?
Actually, sir, the list that is being referenced on page 11, line 18, is in fact the section.
Same statute.
On page 13.
Okay.
Okay. Very good. Senator Stevens.
That's good.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to broach a subject that I know we're about to end here, but I think it's important that we address it. And it's caused me a little consternation. I think you guys have done a great job with taking what we received and making it much better. And my question really goes back to the fundamentals, and that's the title of this Governor's Performance Scholarship. We have changed it in a very major way, from a merit-based to a needs-based. We've changed a lot throughout this. I just have to question the title. I love the governor, and he's done a great job in introducing this, and all the governors in the past, maybe some I don't love quite so much, but why are we calling it the governor's performance? Why not the regent's performance or the commissioner's performance? I don't like the idea of tying it to an individual. I think it's bigger than that. I think it's a scholarship that that we are creating that has great ramifications. We hear for years and years. It'll change education in Alaska in a very major way. I would hope at some time we'd have a discussion on what should be the title of this thing. Should it really be called the Governor's Performance Scholarship, or is there a more appropriate title to it? And I just bring that up because I want to talk about it before, broach it before we leave today, because it's an issue I'd like to see us address.
Okay. All right. Yeah, we can certainly do that and look at that, and also a list of the vocational programs, all three of them, whatever they are, would probably be helpful for people to just feel comfortable with, you know, that aspect of it.
Is that it? If it's okay, I'm just going to burn through the last couple little things.
Okay.
I move pretty fast. If you jump back to page 15, there was a slight linguistic change. It was page 15, lines 10 and 11. The governor's bill had spoken to, had referenced goals of the program because that was being pulled out. Language was included, you know, simply that the data would be presented to you all regarding high school, post-secondary education performance, programmatic changes, graduation rates over time, which I thought was a nice dovetail with Senator Stevens's high school higher education task force, just the kind of information you'd be looking for. Finally, as you move through, there's a large section within the bill where the legislative drafters within statute, if you look at page 17, line 12 and 13, you'll see where it says 14 repealed. That is actually in the existing statute, current statute now, and the drafter simply was taking this opportunity to go ahead and do some statutory cleanup and go ahead and do the renumbering that was implied by that repeal, but that never actually happened. And then finally, at the very end of the bill, there was only one last linguistic change where the drafters took upon themselves to change what had been a plurality to a singular. On page 22, line 16, the governor's bill had referenced so that students in the plural, and our drafters simply changed it to a student, and possibly not open the door to class action lawsuits.
So you're saying basically these last nearly, how many pages is that? Five so pages are really not much to do with the original bill or the committee substitute for the bill. It's simply statute changes that were required that hadn't been already made in most cases from previous changes.
Yes, sir, for the most part.
Okay.
For the most part. Again, it was either identical, the statutory cleanup, or again, the last thing I could find was simply that one word change from, a plurality to a singular.
All right.
I did include, along with, I handed this out to you all, a more of a concise list of the things that we've identified. I've now added inconsistency of grade terms. Our legislative drafter pointed out that we speak of grades, we speak of an A, we speak of high academic performance, high achievement. There are a number of different ways of saying you're an A student within the bill. Normally within statute, they would make them consistent. They wanted us to point that out. There was a structural issue. There were a couple of lines on page 10 that appear that they should actually be in a separate section regarding programmatic flexibility. But again, that's one of the things that Murray and I could clean up. So there were a few things, and I just wanted to, again, bring them to your attention, so we've passed them out for you on a sheet.
Mr. Chairman.
Mayor.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if we'll have the commissioner here on Friday, so it would probably be good if we could at least get some comments, preliminary comments from him. I know we're going to lose Senator Huggins here pretty soon, but if that's okay with you, Mr. Chairman.
That would be good if we could at least try that, and both Senator Huggins and myself will be leaving, so we don't get admonished from the troops upstairs for being late. Yeah. But if you would please come forward, Mr. Commissioner, and put yourself on the record and make some brief comments, and we would certainly like to get you back, or at least have some more comment regarding what seems to be some fairly substantial changes here. So we don't want to expect that in 2 or 3 minutes you would, you know, that would be your only time allotted. We certainly don't want to do that.
For the record, my name is Larry Ledoux. I'm the Commissioner of Education and Early Development. I'm not sure what to say. It was difficult hearing some of the comments and not being able to respond, and so I'll be prepared to respond fully on Friday if I have the time. I appreciated the comments and the questions that you asked, and I think they were very good questions and very good comments, and we will give them close consideration in the next 2 days. I appreciate, there are some really interesting changes that I think add to the effect of scholarship, but one of the things that I would like to say in the brief moments that I have, I think it's very, very important to pay attention to the goals of the program, and I noted that the proposed committee substitute takes them out, but I just wanted to, for the record, mention them again, because the GPS is designed to inspire, encourage, challenge young people to work harder, to take responsibility for choices in what they do, to increase our graduation rate. And I just want to review those, because I think they're very important to frame the context. The GPS is to improve students' performance in high school, to increase high school graduation rates, to improve students' preparation for college work, to improve students' scores on college entrance exams, which are the basis for some national scholarships, to bolster the rigor of high school students' curriculum, to boost students' opportunities for job training, to increase parent involvement in their children's education, and to reduce students' remediation in college, and to increase student academic achievement in institutions of higher education, and provide for timely completion of higher education degrees. It's very important when you're working with young people that we challenge and put a dream in them to be successful. We all know that our high school students are working way under their potential, and that follows them into college and careers. This program is designed to create that dream very early. Our kids are not being successful in college. They're not entering college or careers. And that's the purpose. And you've added some things that I think really help move forward. But I think it's very important as we craft this legislation, we all understand its very purpose. We graduate almost 10,000 students every year, and very few of them are being successful in college. That's an incredible waste of resources, of human and financial resources, for the effect that we have. This program, as it's being revised, as it moves forward, always needs to keep that in mind, or we're not going to achieve our goal. And so I'll be prepared. I really appreciate the revisions. There's some great things there, and I'm hoping that we can have some good deliberative discussions on Friday. I look forward to it, and thank you.
So you will be available then?
Yes, sir. I always am available. Last time this happened, I canceled my I'm here.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Very good. Well, we will close the...
Are you taking up your bill on Friday, or are we taking this up?
Yeah, I think we probably will. Yeah. So we need to do something for that.
Let's see.
It's not up here as far as being mentioned.
Senate Bill 283 Mandatory H.
Oh, it does.
We'll take that up on Friday.
Okay. We'll actually be talking to the commissioner on Friday, and we'll also be taking up SB 283 regarding the mandatory age for school attendance, which lowers the age from 7 to 6 as a mandatory date. And with that, we'll close the meeting and look forward to Friday.